Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbc.com/programs/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catherine-Jones, and we've brought our virtual tent this week to the Technopop Science and Technology Festival, an education event on the London's Olympic Park, where, as you can probably hear, hundreds of school children infused by technology have come to learn more. And with me is our special guest, Paul McKnight from Vex Robotics. He's doing some robot workshops at this show. Paul, I see you've got a couple of robots right in front of me making a bit of noise. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's fantastic to be here and fantastic to be at Technopop.
Great. I'm also joined from the BBC Tech team by Jane Wakefield.
Hello.
And Dave Lee is back at Tech Tent HQ, keeping things ticking over there. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Rory.
Now, here's a little of what we've got coming up for you.
He was put to be a drone pilot because of the skills that he had required gaming.
It's Russian-speaking organized crime that is producing the malware.
Whatever that last thing was, I hope it's not on the loose around here, although there are plenty of strange noises. Stay tuned for that and more. First this week, is the biggest player in smartphones stumbling towards disaster? Samsung's profits have surged in recent years on the back of its hugely successful Galaxy smartphones. But this week, the company warned that its upcoming profits would be 60% down on last year. The reason? It's losing out at the high end to Apple and at the bargain end of the market to Chinese rivals. So where does that leave a company which does so much more than make phones, but has relied on them for its growth? Our correspondent Stephen Evans sent us this postcard from the capital of South Korea, Seoul.
This is Samsung Town writ large. In fact, a section of it with shining new mirror glass and steel headquarters is actually called Samsung Town. In this country, you can be born in a Samsung hospital, live in a Samsung apartment, and end up in a Samsung funeral parlour, truly cradle to grave. And the fun bits in between, because Samsung owns the country's biggest theme park. So, what Samsung does makes Seoul buzz, and it's buzzing about two things at the moment. In particular, the 60% drop in the profits of Samsung Electronics in the July to September quarter. The company's getting squeezed from two ends: cheaper smartphones from China and fiercer competition from Apple. Phones, of course, are part of the fashion business. So the big question here is, does Samsung have the design skills to keep up with the Californians? And the second big buzz in this city is the fate of the chairman. Lee Kun-hee had a heart attack back in May, treated, of course, at the Samsung Medical Center. It's now been learnt that he's had an elevator installed at home here in Seoul, capable of lifting a hospital bed. Here's what the company told me. Quote, "Even though it's not yet decided when he'll leave hospital, we can confirm that an elevator has been installed at the home of our chairman." But then it added, "To make it clear, not only when Chairman Lee will leave the hospital, but also whether is not yet confirmed." So the upshot here in Samsung Town is that who'll run the company way into the future isn't known. The ailing chairman's son is waiting in the wings, but he's an unknown quantity. In Korea, the sun also rises. But when exactly he'll rise, we don't know. And neither, I assume, does he.
Steve Evans in Seoul. Jane Wakefield, what do you think is the real reason that Samsung's having so much trouble right now? I mean, they were on top of the world.
Well, I think it can be summed up in one phrase. The Chinese are coming. You know, they've got these able to produce the same sort of phones much quicker and, you know, much cheaper. And so Samsung's going to have to look to new markets. And I think you can never take for granted the mobile phone market. Look at what happened to Nokia. So everybody has to beware that, you know, there's saturation point and new products might have to sort of be thought about.
It changes so rapidly. Paul McKnight, briefly our special guest, are you a Samsung fan? Is that the kind of phone that you use? You're a technology guy to your fingertips?
Unfortunately, I'm in the Apple yard. so to speak. I got sucked in by the first iPhone and have been an advocate ever since.
And that's exactly Samsung's problem. Squeeze between you, an Apple fancier, and the cheap Chinese Android phones. Well, let's move on. Imagine fighting a real war and killing real people in a faraway land without ever leaving your home country. As violence in the Middle East again intensifies, highly sophisticated weapons will again be put to use. Weapons that require skills very different to those of your traditional foot soldier. Skills the US military has realized that can be found among video gamers. A new documentary by the filmmaker Tonya Hessenshay examines the close relationship between video games and military recruitment and the effects on those who go from playing games to flying combat drones. The film is called Drone.
It's easy to have that detachment and that lack of empathy for human life, and it's easy to really just think of them as something else, you know, they're not people. You know, they're just terrorists.
I came across this story of a gamer who was a high school dropout, and he joined the U.S. Air Force. And very quickly, he was put to be a drone pilot because of the skills that he had required gaming.
It's like it was easy. It was too easy.
They are very good at multitasking. They can concentrate for long periods of time. They're also familiar with, you know, how the interface and the software works. We have been very surprised at the close relationship between the entertainment industry and the military, where they have figured out, you know, how young people think as far as, you know, the software and the design.
And the safety observer is counting down. He counts down to zero. And he says, splash!
The post-traumatic stress that the drone pilots do experience is very similar to, you know, regular soldiers. I was very, very concerned that you actually go from this virtual reality where you get points per kill to then actually sit there and kill real people on the other side of the world through your computer. And I think the psychological toll that it takes to be a drone pilot is something that we're just starting to see the consequences of.
Well, it's easy for them to say, yeah, shoot it, yeah, that's him, shoot it. But they don't have to do the action, and they don't have to live with the repercussions if it turns out that that's not our guy. And we just wait, and we just made orphans out of all these children. You know, they don't have to live with that. Yeah, I do.
Dave Lee, you spoke to Tonya Hessenshay for that piece. You've been trying to get a response from the US military. What have they said?
Department of Defence to discuss the issue of post-traumatic stress in drone pilots. Unfortunately, we're still waiting for a response on that particular issue. But on the topic of recruitment in general, using video games, they say the games show that the military isn't just about carrying weapons and busting down doors. They show it shows a more a modern face to military recruitment.
Some interesting issues there. Dave Lee, thank you very much. Paul McKnight, our special guest this week, you're not a drone man, you're a robotics expert, teaching children about how robots work as an educational tool. But are there interesting ethical issues there in robotics?
I think definitely, and it's in a couple of areas. There's the moral, social and ethical questions around robots replacing humans in the workplace and what long-term effects that will have. But also around the artificial intelligence and how much control we give away, if you like, to robots and what decisions they make by themselves.
Just behind the wall, we're hearing those children shouting and enjoying. There's a robotics class going right on behind us. But they may be playing with toys, as it were, that are going to take their jobs in future. I mean, what's the point of giving them those skills if those robots are going to take their jobs?
Well, the thing is, the robots will still need to be controlled and repaired and also created. So the importance of STEM, science, technology, engineering and maths skills, and that's what we're here promoting today and for the 4 weeks at Technopop, are vastly and massively important that students and the sort of this pipeline of students coming through have these skills that employers are looking for.
Just give us briefly an idea of what you teach these children and how exciting they find it.
So we have two different workshops, and we're teaching them programming using Scratch-like program and also Python, C++, so they're learning how automated machines and processes work. But they're also building robots to complete certain tasks, so they're using design ideas and creativity And they love it because, particularly with the design competition, they can pick them up, drive them around, and that's the excitement that you hear in the background.
Well, I just spent some time watching them, and I can tell you they were having a great time. This is Tech Tent on the BBC World Service with me, Rory Catherine-Jones, live from the Technopop Educational Technology Festival on London's Olympic Park. Still to come, the art of sound in video games. But before we get to that, let's catch up with a couple of the week's other big tech stories. Smartphones have virtually destroyed the casual digital camera market in recent years. We're all snapping away with our phones. The only successful new entrants, though, being the action cameras made by the Californian firm GoPro. Now, HTC, the Taiwanese smartphone maker, is fighting back. It's launched its own separate, small, waterproof action camera. Well, this week I met GoPro's co-founder and CEO Nick Woodman, and he seemed unconcerned by the competition, and he hinted at a new direction for GoPro.
Every time our customers capture and share a GoPro video, they're driving viral awareness and enthusiasm for our brand. They're messaging our value proposition. They're virally driving sales of our products. So in some ways, GoPro is a new type of media company whereby the media that spawns from our hardware goes on to sell the hardware itself. GoPro is already the number one brand channel on YouTube. It's the most engaging brand channel on YouTube. And that's the definition of a media opportunity.
That's Nick Woodman of GoPro. Dave Lee, two of the most prominent figures in tech have been saying quite controversial things in the last 24 hours.
Yes, they have. First, we had the head of Microsoft, Satya Nadella. He's been apologising over comments he made telling women at his company not to ask for pay rises and instead to, quote, have faith in the system. He picked a bad audience. He was speaking at a conference celebrating women in technology. He later said he had been completely wrong and that he absolutely supported equal pay. Meanwhile, 800 miles away, Apple design boss Johnny Ive was addressing an event hosted by the US magazine Vanity Fair. In that, an audience member asked him what he thought of Xiaomi, the Chinese company that we've that have been said to be copying, in some people's eyes, Apple's designs. He responded in general terms, and he said that companies that copy Apple were lazy and that it amounted to theft.
Jane Wakefield, you definitely deserve a pay rise this week because you've had a scoop about how suspected criminals are managing to outwit the police when it comes to the data on their mobile phones.
Yeah, so this is a technology that is basically designed to allow you to get rid of data on your phone should your phone be stolen and you've got sensitive things on there that you don't want people to see. So it's very easy now to be able to kind of remotely wipe everything from your phone. But it's also being used by criminals, or potentially associates of criminals or suspected criminals, perhaps we should say. So if a phone is taken into police custody, there's been some cases in the UK of those phones being wiped of all the information whilst they're in police custody.
And not by the police?
Not by the police, no. By somebody associated with the case that maybe doesn't want the police to see what's on their phone.
Interesting, it works both ways, because we're told that we can wipe our own phones if they're stolen, but of course the criminals can wipe their phones if the police get hold of them.
They're always one step ahead, aren't they?
Moving on. The biggest technology issue concerning many police forces is actually their battle with the increasingly confident cyber criminals. This week, one of the people leading that fight told me that the number of really sophisticated cyber crooks behind malicious software is actually quite limited, and just about all of them come from one part of the world. Truls Erting is the head of Europol's Cybercrime Centre, and I asked him where the biggest threat came from.
It's Russian-speaking organized crime that is producing the malware, and they're also the one that is testing the malware. And then it's downloaded by all kinds of criminals that could be Western European criminals and Eastern European criminals or African or American criminals. But the majority of the kingpins seems right now to be located in the Russian-speaking area. It's not from the Russian Federation, but it's all Russian-speaking.
Are you happy with the cooperation you're getting from the authorities in places like Russia at the moment?
I am increasingly happy because I've just been in Moscow a couple of times and I've just made an agreement that we will come with four very, very interesting cases to them and then we'll see the outcome, of course. But so far it seems to be going in the right direction, actually.
Do you have the skills to actually keep up with these increasingly sophisticated cyber criminals? Or are they, frankly, ahead of the game?
I think they have an advantage in many ways. First of all, after the Snowden affair, there has been also by the good guys at the internet, I think, what is confusion between privacy and anonymity. I think that you have privacy and you have a right to privacy, but that doesn't mean that you have a right to be anonymous. There must be a possibility for law enforcement with a warrant from a judge that there is a suspicion to actually also enter some information. Right now, it seems that we are going more for encryption, more for making it difficult for everybody, including the police, to actually identify people. So this is, of course, of concern. When you talk about our skills, I think we can still cope, but the criminals are, they're more people, they have more resources. But still, if we are good enough to identify the rather limited group of good programmers that I think we roughly know who are, if we can target them and take them out of the equation, then the rest will fall down until they have been replaced, and they are not so many.
How many do you think are behind most of this cybercrime?
I would guess that there will be around 100 good programmers globally right now. There might be a bit more, a bit less, but that will be in the area.
That's Trils Oerting, head of Europol's cybercrime centre. Now, video games are all about amazing 3D graphics, right? Well, yes, but an important and often overlooked feature about what makes a game a hit is the sound. And it is a very sophisticated business, as dedicated gamer and BBC Tech Desk editor Leo Kellyan has been finding out.
The scream of the monster in Alien Isolation, and news that you've been slaughtered yet again. The video game from Sega is based on Ridley Scott's 1979 horror movie and involves the player guiding the protagonist across a space station trying to stay out of the alien's grasp.
One of the most important parts of sound is it's quite an emotional medium, and it works on like a subconscious level, really. So it can evoke all kinds of feelings like anxiety, fear, happiness, tension.
Byron Bullock, the game's sound designer at the Creative Assembly. More than one reviewer has called Alien Isolation the most terrifying game they've ever played. And much of their anxiety is down to the effects created by Bullock and his team.
We definitely want to immerse the player, so we are going for a sense of realism. But at the same time, all the sounds have to have an emotional context to them. So things like the motion tracker, for example, as soon as you hear that beep, it puts you on edge because you don't always see where that sound's coming from. But it's almost got like a heartbeat to it, and it gets faster and faster and higher in pitch. And that can drive like an emotional reaction. It can make you feel anxious.
Of course, video game sound effects aren't all about fear. In the case of football simulation FIFA 15, much of the effort has been put into recreating the effect of being on the pitch surrounded by spectators. Studio EA Sports used to record about 30 people in a room and get them to sing each chant over and over, layering each recording on top of another to create the effect of a large crowd. These days it goes to the considerably more expensive effort of sourcing recordings from matches played all over the world. Sound director Jeffrey McPherson says it's all about authenticity.
Somebody who's singing in a studio is going to do a much different sort of performance than somebody who's truly out there supporting their team on a Saturday afternoon. And that emotional content comes through, you know, as humans, even if it's just in chanting and crowds and singing, you know, with our 10,000 or whatever years of evolution, we can really hear those sort of, you know, not the words, but just the content, the emotional content of what's being said or sung. And it's just, there's no substituting the real deal.
But you can't always find the sound you want in the real world. US studio Bungie recently released the sci-fi shooter Destiny, in which the gamer battles with various species of aliens, each one sounding different to the other. The game's sound director, C. Paul Johnson, explained to me how he took his inspiration for one kind, the Vex, from an unlikely source.
I was listening to a podcast, and there was a guy who did a piece of performance art where he took a YouTube video of himself and uploaded it to YouTube, and then ripped it, and then uploaded it to YouTube again, and then ripped it, and did that about 1,200 times. And he ended up with this really crazy sound that sounded mechanical and robotic, but yet had emotiveness to it. We came up with a process where we, I think we used the source of big cats, like cheetahs or something, and ran it through a process like that where we encoded it to MP3 and then decoded it, and we could adjust how many times, but it was hundreds and hundreds of times.
Not all video game sound effects have to be in your face. In fact, their creators suggest the best are often only picked up by your subconscious. The sound you're hearing in the background is a flute that forms part of a wind effect in Ubisoft Montreal's forthcoming game Far Cry 4, which is set in the Himalayas. This is the final effect. The idea is to create a sense of desolation. It's quite subtle, and sound director Tony Gronick says that's exactly the point.
It's nice to just hear that wind blowing without the music or without distant explosions going off. You know, you're in this world for 40 plus hours. You can't bombard people with sound from the start to finish. You need to be able to give them highs and lows. Otherwise, sonically, their ears are just going to be, you know, shot.
Leo Kellyan there making some lovely noises. Special guest roboticist Paul McKnight, tell us a bit more about what the young people visiting this tech festival that we're at have been learning. I mean, after all, one imagines that they know all this stuff already. They've grown up with technology, this generation.
Exactly. We started the show with smartphones, and kids get them, they know how to use them instantly, but what they don't maybe realise straight away is that there's an awful lot of design that's gone into making them work. It might be the physical, mechanical design, product design, but it's also the computer science to make them work, and it's about exciting the younger generation to be the people that are going to create the next, you know, technological jump in smartphones or in robots or whatever the technology is.
Is there a sense that we've got too obsessed with learning coding, which a lot of children will find quite tedious, and we need to translate it into physical things, like robots, like 3D printers I see out there as well?
Exactly. You know, Scratch is a fantastic way of getting students in interested in programming and understanding the concepts. But what you can do if you program on a robot, that translates what's on screen into a physical product. If it doesn't work, they can work out why it's not worked because of when the robot stopped moving.
Jane Wakefield, you and I have followed this debate about coding and children. What's your experience? Is it really beginning to make a change? Are children getting to understand computers in a way that they weren't?
I think the changes in the curriculum are at very early stages, but things like this where, you know, kids can come along and play with robots and see things that they can make with their own hands that are using a different language to anything they've come across before are really, really important in making them sort of start thinking in a more technical and logical way. And that, at the end of the day, is what people want, you know, from this, is people that will think and, as you say, create the next generation of apps and the next generation of products.
Well, we are running out of time. I'm looking at two lovely robots. Unfortunately, one of them has had its batteries go flat. A problem with everything in technology. Thanks to Paul McKnight, Jane Wakefield and Dave Lee. Don't forget, you can find out more about all of today's stories on our BBC Technology site, bbc.com/technology. And join us in the tech tent at the same time next week.